afternoon. We're going to get started. It's my pleasure to introduce our final company today, E*TRADE Financial, a leading financial services company and pioneer in the online brokerage industry. With us today is E*TRADE, is Mike Pesce, Chief Operating Officer and Chief Financial Officer. Mike has been at E*TRADE since 2003, serving in various roles, including Corporate Treasurer and CFO, and his role was recently expanded to include COO. Thanks, Mike, for taking the time at being at the conference. Maybe to kick it off, start off with the strategic update on the third quarter call. So you laid out a path to get to greater than $7 of earnings per share by 2023. Based on the assumptions that you set out, it looks achievable. It would just be good maybe to get a better understanding of maybe the areas of opportunity to outperform and maybe any of the areas of risk in achieving the goal.
Sure. And thanks, Mike. Thanks for having us here today. It's our first time presenting at this conference. We realize that we've been uncommonly public in setting out some long-term financial metrics and goals that we want to hit in the long-term plan. And when we set out to model the company, we looked to sort of develop a model of the in-force business over that period that if we execute well, we can show clearly the value generation. This is not a new exercise for us. We model the company consistently all the time, every year for a strategic and capital planning cycle. We do monthly updates. We have active discussions and dialogue with our board around it. All of this really is sort of we wanted to be very transparent in the way we as management see the company, how we see the company generating value into the future, and how we present the company to the board. And we wanted to be very transparent about it at this time. Looking at sort of the sort of risks and the opportunities within the plan, as we look at kind of the success we're having with the TCA acquisition and advisor services, we see real potential. But it's still early days, and we're fairly conservative in the modeling of the plan overall. In terms of the digital space, what the product set that we're putting forward in terms of robo, in terms of managed investment portfolios, all areas of clear opportunity within the plan because they're not large for us today, but we expect to scale them and grow them over time. But obviously, we feel we've got some potential to really outperform. Now, in terms of just the base assumptions of the plan, we assume about 5% market growth per year. We assume, nothing heroic really from the market, from the interest rate cycle, really just the forward curve, two rate hikes next year and one the following year. And then equally important, cash as a percentage of customer assets. We hold relatively flat at 13% in the plan and hold it at that level throughout, allowing sort of the cash generation mechanism to sort of play through. We have stressed the plan to address sort of the risk development. We've looked at it from the standpoint of commission sensitivity, interest sensitivity, margin sensitivity, looking at different sensitivities and scenarios around the plan, and have really spent a lot of time looking at those scenarios, and in all of them, for reasonable sets of circumstances, both within the competitive environment and within the macro economy, we see clear, compelling value generation over that period. And so, when we look at real risks to the plan, what we're really talking about is really a fundamental shift in the term structure of interest rates, substantially lower. Something much like we saw in the financial crisis, a return to zero interest rate policy, QE, that's what generates real risk to achieving the plan, not sort of modest changes in the environment that we're in. We see the plan as relatively robust. We feel we've got a great model to manage sort of the market changes and sort of changes in the competitive landscape as we continue to execute, and we believe strongly that we're going to be able to deliver the plan.
Okay. So one of the risks that's been out there more for the overall industry is just on commission pricing and further compression there. So how do you think about that within the outlook or the model?
Sure, good question. Topic in every meeting today. First and foremost, I think you have to start with where is the customer. The customer has never gotten a better deal from this industry. If you're trading with us and you're in your active trader segment, you're $4.95. If you're not in the active trader, $6.95. It's the lowest commissions ever. You're getting professional grade tools, incredible service. great sort of interaction with the company, and you're getting all that for an unbelievable deal. You're getting the best execution quality the industry has ever delivered. And so it's just a really, it's a compelling value equation for the customer. So you have to start to say, why should commissions really go lower? And when we look at it, we're not seeing that from the customer. In fact, we see the opposite. We see a demand for service, a demand for platform, in terms of providing more expertise, more help and assistance to the customer. So what we see is a compelling opportunity for our model. Now, stepping back from that, we looked at kind of what happened last year as sort of just a transfer of value, moving value from the shareholder to the customer. All parties within the industry adjusted when the rack rate commissions were cut in early 2017. Within a few short weeks, the whole industry had priced down. There's no compelling or discernible shift in share. There's no change in sort of asset growth outside of sort of the macro backdrop. The pricing change really did nothing to deliver anything from a value perspective. We're just not in an industry where cutting price allows for an expansion of the profit pool so everybody wins. There's no profit pool at the margin to expand. Pricing is already very low. When we look at our business, we feel we've got some good resiliency. We've built a great option platform. Options not only have sort of the ticket charge, but sort of the contracts per trade. So a very resilient business on the commission side overall. It's also where the customer really cares about sort of the platform, the experience, the service that we deliver. And so we feel that's a great business for us. And then additionally, on the corporate services side, we have resiliency in commission, and that commission sort of contractual to the B2B platform. Overall, if we were to have to cut commissions, and I think it would be a poor thing for the industry, a $1 drop in rack rate would cost us about $50 million in revenue. So it's really quite manageable for us if we have to move through the environment. But we don't, we don't think that's really the right thing for the industry.
Okay. And then maybe just moving to rates, just given where we are in the cycle, maybe just discuss the earnings sensitivity to rates, short rates, the curve, and maybe just an update on the outlook for deposit betas.
Sure. Obviously net interest, very important, 65% of total revenue. So the rate environment matters a great deal. We have a phenomenal deposit base. We're going to have about a 25 basis points of expense on the liability or deposit side of the balance sheet in Q4. We're reinvesting in sort of that 300 to 325 basis point range. And we're holding very well overall in terms of the environment, in terms of cash balances that we see. So from where we sit today, looking at sort of the deposit beta, we think about 20% is the right beta. Historically, that's been about the average. Now, when rates first started to go up, we didn't react. The betas were close to zero. Right. We caught up a little bit because we had to. And we think 20% is about the right level going forward. For a 25 basis point move today, we'll gain about $30 million to $35 million of income over the next 12 months. So that's sort of a bit of the sensitivity of where we're at today. The yield curve, that's a parallel move. The yield curve shape and sensitivities are a bit different. They're a bit harder to quantify. Obviously, if we can see a continual flattening from here, you get to a point of almost an inversion. If that were to occur, we could use our off-balance sheet capabilities in a more meaningful way versus on. So it's a bit different to sort of measure the sensitivities to curve shape from this point. But in general, 25 basis points is in that 30 to 35 million range.
Okay. So client engagement has been great for E-Trade, the overall industry. You mentioned cash balance, though, have trended lower. So how do you think about maybe the natural offset, those dynamics, throughout, a cycle?
Yeah. Engagement has been exceptional. I mean, you saw that just in what we put out this morning. 302,000 DARTs for the month of October, our third best month in DARTs ever. Margin book holding at about $11.2 billion, so near record balances, so substantial engagement from the customer and the margin side. It is a great environment for engagement. It's been a great year, and that's building off of engagement that was exceptional in 2017. Looking at engagement, you know, we like to look at customer net buying activity. 2017 was a record at $9.1 billion. 2018 is shaping up to be a record. You know, just year to date, we're above, you know, through the end of the third quarter, we're well above where we were in 2017 for the full year. All of that is just symptomatic of a high level of customer engagement. Customers are very active. They're involved in the market. We've seen, you know, the activity, you know, the active customer coming in and buying the dips and changes in the volatility in the market. But all that has, as you pointed out, put pressure on cash balance. Cash balance is 13% of assets. It's at the lower end of kind of where we've been historically in terms of a percent of client assets, and that's because that engagement is so high. As we think about that over a long-term sort of plan, engagement levels versus cash levels really offset one another in a meaningful way. As engagement falls down, cash tends to build. You can think about that right back to the net buying numbers that I talked about earlier. As customers net buy, that's funded out of cash. That puts a pressure on the cash balance. The growth in the business replenishes that cash. If the amount of activity of buy goes down, then that cash will grow over time, periodically. In any given period, it may not over offset perfectly, but over the long run, we see meaningful offsets within the business.
Okay. We kind of hit on the betas and then the cash balances, but would you expect to see, I mean, customers move cash, you know, out of the sweep to look for higher yield? I mean, are there certain scenarios that, you know, would play out where you would have to, you know, increase, you know, the rates that you're paying even further? Or is that 20% still, you know, pretty approximate?
We have a very unique customer base and a very strong deposit franchise. And I think you have to kind of look at sort of the averages here because they really tell you the story. You know, in terms of the average account size of being $100,000, 13% held in cash is about $13,000. We're not talking about large cash portions. This isn't the large cash allocation of a larger investment portfolio. It's the customer's dry powder. It's the dividends and interest that have been deposited into the account over time that the customer will periodically come in and put back to work in the marketplace. So overall, it's a remarkably sticky, rate-insensitive deposit. You know, if you go back in time to the pre-crisis environment when you had much higher rates, in a 5% sort of funds LIBOR type world, we were paying 1% on our sweep deposits, and we were having no problem growing them in line with business growth. For the core customer, for the average customer, we don't see why that relationship has changed. It has not changed. That's why we think 20% is the right beta. Now, for a customer that says, I'm out of the market, I've moved my account to cash, I don't like this market, I want to sit in cash, wait to go back in. For a customer that's sort of looking for a savings product, looking for a place to earn some yield, you have to have the right product for them. We've recently introduced our savings product we've had it out in test for a couple market segments. We've made it, you know, broad-based within our bank. We believe we've got the right product mix. There's no reason for that customer to forge a relationship with another institution to move that money out and to hold it somewhere else to earn yield. We can give them that product when they want that product.
Okay. Maybe from a product standpoint, how are you thinking about expanding the product set, maybe on the banking side, and maybe why that's important, and then, you know, just how to manage the credit risk, you know, if you are successful, you know, doing that?
Sure. When we talk about banking, what we're really talking about is sort of transactional products in the cash space for our customers. You know, whether that's sort of payment functionality, savings, checking, bill pay. Because what we did is we looked at carefully at, we have all these products today, and we looked carefully at sort of how we would, you know, the cohorts of customers who actively use our banking products versus customers who don't. And what we saw was striking. Three times the average assets, double the trade volumes, 5% better retention, taking retention up in excess of 97%. It's clearly a large improvement in the lifetime value of the customer if they're engaging with us on the banking side from a transactional cash management perspective. We want to be able to provide that for our customers. We want it to be a high quality experience in the space. While we have the products today, we have a little bit of work to do in making that, making those products as high a quality as we would like from a user experience potential. But we feel that the value increase we get from providing that to the customer is significant just from the stats that I just gave. I mean, it's a clearly compelling way to drive value out of the customer base.
Okay. So one of the newer areas here for E-Trade is the advisor services with TCA. So what are you doing to accelerate, you know, that growth relative to when TCA was independent?
We are very excited about the growth opportunity in TCA. Let's go back to some of the reasons we gave around the acquisition and talk a little bit about how that frames against the current pipeline that we gave on the third quarter call. When we acquired TCA, what we saw prior to TCA was customers would grow up, they would season with us, they would gain assets into sort of a material asset range, and then they would be highly sold into the advised segment. Without having a custody platform, without having advisors on a custody platform, we would lose a portion of those assets. So in buying TCA, we can set up a referral program to TCA's advisors that allows us to capture that share. That's the one of the fundamental reasons behind the acquisition of TCA. And that applies also into our corporate services participants as well to our customers. What that also creates, though, is we are a large pool of assets that's setting up an active referral program. And what we see is RIA customers coming to us to say they want to be part of that referral program when we set it up. That becomes a very powerful sales tool on the RIA side of the relationship. And that's really what you've seen in the pipeline of assets that has formed. We couldn't be more pleased. We have $1 billion of assets on from April already, from when we closed the deal. And we have $12 billion of pipeline that have been signed, and that includes an industry stalwart in Edelman Financial.
Okay. And how, just, you know, on the advisor services, how do the fees, you know, maybe compare, you know, to the competition or what else, you know, is out there in the industry?
Well, everyone has a little bit different fee model in terms of how they charge versus transaction versus assets. We center the fee portion of the model in a basis point charge on assets versus direct transactions, with then some other transaction related revenue for specific other itemized transactions. It's just sort of the nature of how TCA always went to market. We're not going to change that. We think it's a compelling way in terms of the overall platform. But we think where we end up is in a very competitive product overall versus the other players in the marketplace.
Okay. And then just given the relative size, yet, you know, it sounds like attractive, you know, growth opportunity. Are you looking at potentially, you know, doing more acquisitions in that space, you know, to increase the scale?
Well, I think there's always an open door for acquisitions, but I wouldn't necessarily describe it as just to increase scale. It's more from a capability perspective. Is there anything that we can acquire that would give us a leg up on growth, that would accelerate the growth of this channel further? You know, if you think about the advisory segment, anything you can do to reduce the administrative burden on the advisor of running his own business, and that allows him to go out and sell more, to gain more business into his channel, makes the custody platform a more compelling offering. Now, what's important about that is we bought an open architecture platform. It doesn't have to be an acquisition. We can actively partner with people who want to put their services onto our custody platform, and we can go to market together. So we keep the door open for acquisitions, but there's lots of ways we can sort of improve the ecosystem of product that we're bringing forth to the advisors.
Okay. So another, you know, area of the business that you guys talk a lot, you know, about is corporate services. And, you know, it's seen significant growth in both, you know, the accounts and the assets. So maybe what has driven that growth, and then how does that flow through, you know, into the retail business, you know, to generate, you know, more to the bottom line?
Sure. We saw very early on that corporate services for us had the potential to be a strategic differentiator. We think it is that differentiator today. It's an area, therefore, that we invested in over a long period of time. We made those investments, even sort of the darkest times in our history during the crisis, we made investments in the corporate services platform and keep developing and pushing forward the software there. What we're seeing is sort of the payoff of that investment to some degree, in the sense that we have the best product in the marketplace for stock plan administrators. We have listened to administrators. We have heard what they wanted. We've incorporated the best elements of software design. We have the latest in reporting, the best in functionality. That makes their job a lot easier. If you can make the HR, the HR administrator's job easier from a record keeping standpoint, if you have an offering that's sort of simple and easy to use for the employee experience and the participant experience, you've got something that is really sort of saleable into that space. That is what we've done. And so what we're doing now is focusing on our market position, on making sure that we are very active in this, very active in anything that is coming to RFP. I mean, we have an amazing stat. We won 75% of plans that went out to RFP last year. So we are starting from a position of share, and we think we have an opportunity to continue growing that share over time. We've grown the assets in this business from $150 billion to $260 billion, $110 billion of growth over the last 2 years. We feel really good about what's going on in corporate services. We are listening to our customers. We're planning the next level of investments in the software and continuing to drive forward in that business.
Okay. And then I think you guys you would give over time just in terms of the retention rates. Do you anticipate increasing those in retention rates over time? And again, how would that kind of impact or benefit the business?
Yeah, I mean, the retention rate today, so 12 months post vest, is about 15%. So if you think about what we've done by growing the assets $110 billion, we set up to retain about 15% of that 110 when it flows through, right? And so the growth in the underlying pipeline matters. But obviously, if we could scale it in both dimensions, it would be even more powerful. If we can grow the funnel, but yet retain more of what's coming out the funnel, that would be even better, right? So, obviously, what are we working on? Well, we're making sure that every participant experience from the day they onboard is a high quality experience, full service offering, full touch across the board to make sure every participant feels sort of the experience of using our platform and what we have to offer. We've invested greatly in our digital distribution of investment products. We're making sure the participants know they're there. That's going to be our core portfolios, which is our robo offering, our managed investment portfolios. We've continued to invest in sort of the FC force and training the FC force to sell into that channel. And then lastly, and we think very importantly, is partnering with regional or national advisors or even local advisors where it makes sense through a referral network to help increase distribution into that channel. We think all of that will have a meaningful impact on that 15% over time, but make no mistake, if we can succeed in continuing to grow the size of the business, we don't really need to move the 15% to be incredibly successful at generating value.
Right.
But we think we've got the right tools to do that as well.
Okay. So one of the drivers, of the $7 plus in EPS power is an improving operating margin, to over 50% over time. So maybe what differentiates, E-Trade from others in the industry in being able to hit that margin level, just given, where margins are today and maybe where we are, in the cycle?
Yeah, so I think two things are very important. One, we lead with digital. We are a digital firm. What that really means is we get an enormous amount of efficiency and distribution through leading with a digital channel. To the extent that you have, the human touch enters it, it's largely through our national sales center in Sandy, Utah, another highly efficient way to sort of access the customer. We don't have the sort of extensive brick and mortar expense of a lot of financial services and the diffuse labor force that comes from that and the inflationary pressure that puts. Being digital gives us the ability to be very efficient, and we see that as a clear competitive advantage in overall level of operating margin. In addition to that, most of our business, with the exception of what we acquired from TCA, is really direct to the self-directed retail customer. that is generating a higher revenue yield on client assets than the advised channel, even our own advised channel. But when we compare that to the competitive set, if you've got a much larger advisory channel that's operating at a much lower operating margin, then obviously then you have sort of the weighted average effect of those businesses. For us, we are in a much better position in terms of being more direct to retail and operating at a substantially higher revenue yield overall.
Okay. So maybe just getting back to the client base. So another area that's been very strong is account growth. And I think that finished above, you know, the targeted growth range. Maybe when you dig into it, you know, how has the quality, you know, the accounts, you know, been trending, you know, in addition to, you know, the growth?
Sure. Well, we're very pleased with account growth, 210,000 accounts over the trailing 12 months. You know, that is 5.9%, so a tenth of a point above the upper end of our growth target range going into sort of the two-year assessment period. So we feel very good about what we've done about trying to drive account growth overall. But I'm glad you asked about quality, because I think there's an even more compelling story there. We've been able to grow high-value accounts by 25% over that same period. How we define a high value account is an account where we generate a minimum of $500 in revenue. And what we're seeing there is that is the payoff of really the integration of the OH acquisition, focusing on education in the option portion of the business, growing assets with customers over time, making sure we have our sort of investment product portfolio, using the FC Force to continue to penetrate and grow wallet share with our customer base. What we're seeing is the quality of accounts and the quality of our marketing and generating those accounts all really lift that high value number.
Okay. And then on the net new asset side, so growth, you know, there has been a little bit, you know, more, you know, challenging relative to the growth target, and probably not too surprising just given the mix of business. But how do you think about maybe the net new asset, you know, versus the revenue yield, and then how that compares relative to peers?
Well, sure. I mean, we have succeeded in accelerating asset growth. We just did not achieve our goal in the period. We had a record year last year, $12.1 billion. We're on pace to a record year this year. So we feel good about everything that we've put in place to really accelerate that asset growth. Now, as we say, sometimes accounts come first. Customer opens up an account, funds it with cash, assets follow later. So asset growth occurs over a longer period of time. I also, you know, want to be clear on the way we measure net new assets is extremely conservative versus the industry. Because of the presence of our stock plan business, we only call something a net new asset when the customer transacts, not when there simply is a vest transaction. So we have $90 billion of securities that show up in our securities holdings that really have never passed through net new assets. That obviously lifts the denominator of the calculation, but there's nothing flowing through the numerator. And that sort of biases the number lower. If you just took point to point, sort of where we are in total customer assets, over the last year we grew it in excess of 20%, and over the last 2 years we grew it at almost 50%. Take out the sort of the growth in the market over those periods, and we have significant growth in excess of our competitors in total assets. And so, you know, that's not to say we're not trying to move the goalpost. We understood our definition when we declared we need the goal. We measured to that definition. But there are nuances in sort of the comparisons to the competitive set, and we just want to make sure everyone understands that as they look at sort of value generation going forward. Now, asking specifically about revenue yield, we're more than two times our largest competitor in terms of revenue yield on client assets. Again, that's because we are focused direct to the retail customer. We don't have to grow assets as fast to grow revenue as fast. If we are growing assets as fast, then we're growing revenue at an even faster rate. And I think that's an important takeaway in just understanding net new asset comparisons across the industry.
Okay. So one of the other drivers of the $7, you know, EPS was capital return in terms of buybacks. So you guys announced a $1 billion plan, initiated a dividend. But how do you think about like the capital return, you know, versus reinvestments that are needed, you know, to deliver like the top line growth?
Yeah, I mean, we feel very good about our project portfolio and sort of the investments that we make. Like all companies, you know, we have a detailed amount of project investment. You have roll-off of project investments so that you can redeploy. We've upped the amount of investment both really in our overall technology areas and as well as in marketing. You see the marketing, it's really quite clearly. We upped it in 17, we upped it in 18. We've made substantial investments in the growth in the business. And we're not going to shy away from investments if there's a clear, compelling driver of value from them. But we feel very good about the overall level of investment spend within the company right now relative to the balance of buybacks. Capital return is an important dimension of getting to the $7 of EPS, as you highlighted. And we're, you know, and we've been very active already with $120 million of purchases thus far, and really continuing to deliver that capital back to our shareholders. We feel it's an important part of the value equation in terms of getting to our overall financial goals.
Okay. And then one of the transactions that you guys did was the Capital One accounts, and I think you guys, you know, put out an update today in terms of closing and just the accretion, but maybe just like an update, you know, in terms of how that, you know, has played out and then the potential opportunity that you see over time.
Yeah, I mean, we are thrilled with the opportunity set that we closed on over the weekend and announced today. A million new relationships. I mean, it's hard, you know, to be able to convert and onboard a million new accounts. I mean, really hats off to our ops team, our tech team, our service team. Just did an exceptional job over the weekend and today, really just onboarding all of these customers. There is real potential there. You know, these are customers who have in some way interacted in a self-directed way through their prior platform. We're now putting in a more capable platform in front of them, a more capable service offering. These customers have sort of lower wallet share and engagement than the overall E-Trade population, but we feel that we're going to be able to move them over time upward in that engagement curve, putting more product in front of them, really working with them in sort of a service capacity, making sure they understand now what value and opportunity they have at their fingertips. All that said, if we sort of get nothing more than what we bought in terms of sort of the transaction volumes and the cash volumes, we're going to eclipse the six cent EPS accretion that we talked about when we announced the deal. That's a function of a better rate environment and sort of just the underlying business, you know, business changes since we announced the acquisition. So we couldn't be happier on the financial side as well as just the long-term business potential of this acquisition.
Okay. So just on the strategic update, so you laid out, you know, the roadmap to deliver attractive growth, you know, over the next few years versus the sale. Just how did the plan impact, you know, maybe the board's, you know, strategic evaluation, and then how does it impact, you know, maybe the longer term, you know, potential options on the strategic side?
Yeah, well, as I said earlier on, the long-term planning is not a new thing. We do it all the time. But it is the basis of valuation. So, you know, the management team outlined a detailed strategy of what it would do with sort of the in-force model of the company to deliver value creation over into the future. And 5 years is sort of what we use as a planning cycle. That's sort of how we get to 5 years. We felt that we had to be very transparent with our shareholders in sort of communicating that value generation of how we saw the company and how we presented that value generation to the board. The board's process really was to take that model output, that strategy, hire a third-party advisor. That third-party advisor evaluated the model, evaluated the assumptions, the environmental factors, the growth variables, really did a rigorous review of everything really within the company model, and then really performed a third-party valuation assessment independent of the company's management to value the company, and then really presented that results to the board with a set of sort of what they saw as likely alternative value scenarios, and really looked at sort of the organic value generation capability versus alternatives, and that is sort of what the board deliberated on to really arrive at how they view the company. And I think, you know, I think there's a bit of a view of saying it's a sort of a stay independent versus sell. It's really not it. We have a clear plan that generates value over 5 years. If someone wants to come in and buy that plan, they want to own that growth potential, and they want to sort of deliver synergy above that growth potential, the board is open to any dialogue that will create an advanced shareholder value above what we see as the organic potential.
Okay. So we have a little bit of time left. Maybe we'll open it up to the audience to see if there's any questions. And then I have maybe one more.
Yeah, I'm just curious how your role is changing as you've adopted the COO title as well as CFO.
Sure. Over my career at E-Trade, I've done a lot of different jobs, but even as CFO, I've taken on additional items. But late last quarter, I took on the additional role of all of the company's operations segment. So everything that would fall under operations now is really with me as well. And it's really sort of a great time in sort of in looking at sort of that area, taking it on. You know, we have sort of the immediacy of the Capital One conversion, and really focusing on delivery of that. I think the team did an exceptional job, across all areas, but my team as well did an exceptional job really in sort of getting that conversion done. But really beginning to look at sort of ways in which we can drive, greater operating leverage across the, across our franchise. How can we be smarter with technology? How can we automate? How can we change upstream code to be even more efficient than we already are? So really driving sort of that continuous improvement across the firm is really an area that I'm excited to really focus on a firm-wide effort, not just in things that are sort of reporting up to me.
One in the back.
Thanks for your comments. It's very interesting. You mentioned that hooking in banking products to the self-directed is leading to a lot lower churn and better customer outcomes. It seems as if bank competitors have noticed the same dynamic, but from a different perspective, which is let's add self-directed to banking products that'll get better. Are there any product capabilities they bring to the offering from a research perspective or anything else, or anything in part of their offering that you worry about that you'd have to adopt your product set to match what they're doing, or do you think that they're just way behind with this clientele?
Well, I mean, I think, from a banking perspective, E-Trade has always had a banking presence. We've taken that customer capability and have always had it out there. It's just something we haven't really focused on as much in the past. For a long period, we had our sort of own system of balance sheet constraints around capital and deleverage initiatives. Some of these businesses obviously generate deposits to some degree. I think now we can focus on it, and when we look at those kind of cohorts, we see the clear value. I think that from a distribution standpoint, it's really the customer's desire to bring about their financial relationship to manage their money. So if you have the better platform in sort of the investing space, you have the investing share, you can gain the banking share over time by making sort of a compelling digital offering in that space, provided you have the ability to operate as a bank.
Any other questions? Maybe one last one, and then we can wrap it up. Same on the competitive side, just in terms of new entrants, there's obviously other players, out there, but it's also, already fairly competitive. And so having scale, seems like, a pretty big, advantage. But when you look at the competitive landscape, anything from, outside sort of the core, competitors that makes you, like worry?
Well, obviously we've seen a lot, right? We've seen JP Morgan with the UInvest app, in the last quarter. We've seen, we hear a lot about Robinhood's business. All of these things, we spend a lot of time looking at any entrant in the space. Anything really that's kind of going on in financial technology, we're going to look and say why that's gaining customers, whether it's a good revenue model or not. What is compelling about it to gain customers, and what can we learn, right? I think what people miss is there's a lot of financial companies that sort of start and there's nothing compelling about them and they sort of fade away. But anyone that sort of begins to get traction, we're going to look at and say, well, what are they doing, right? And I think this is where we're looking at sort of making sure that we're always developing user experience, that we're always engaging the customer, developing our offering. We're not going to change our model. We think having a fully capable service offering, backing up what we do, is the right model for sophisticated traders. We think people are going to want to call in and talk to people. We've got extensive service teams. We've got a big team of derivative specialists out in Chicago. We believe we've built the right sort of view. But when in the fintech space, we're going to look at everything, evaluate it from a competitive threat, but also say, what are they doing that's sort of driving their customer engagement, and how do we sort of learn from other players in the industry? We think we lead in a lot of areas, but we're sort of competitively always reviewing to say, how can we be better? How can we improve?
Okay. All right, we'll wrap it up there. I want to thank Mike for his time and insight. Thanks again.
Thank you.